Ambangala Manuralari.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, you have a shake.
6.
At the exit of White Columns sits a black car curled up like a panther, a burnished steel lens reflecting the low glow of Oahu Road. It is a unit. It is a mobile unit of Medicops Unlimited. A silvery badge is embossed on its door. A chrome-plated cop badge the size of a dinner plate, bearing the name of said private peace organization and emblazoned, "Dial 1-800-THE-COPS," all major credit cards. Medicops Unlimited is the official peacekeeping force of White Columns, and also of the Mews at Windsor Heights, the Heights at Bear Run, Cinnamon Grove, and the Farms of Cloverdell. They also enforce traffic regulations on all highways and byways operated by Fairlanes, Inc. A few different FOQNEs also use them, Caymans Plus and the Alps, for example. But franchise nations prefer to have their own security force. You can bet that Medizania and New South Africa handle their own security. That's the only reason people become citizens, so they can get drafted. Obviously, Nova Sicilia has its own security, too. Narcolumbia doesn't need security because people are scared just to drive past the franchise at less than 100 miles an hour. YT always snags a nifty power boost in neighborhoods thick with Narcolumbia consulates. And Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, the granddaddy of all FOQNEs, handles it in a typically Hong Kong way, with robots. Medicop's main competitor, Worldbeat Security, handles all roads belonging to cruiseways, plus has worldwide contracts with Dixie Traditionals, Pickett's Plantation, Rainbow Heights, check it out, 2 apartheid burbclaves, and 1 for black suits, Meadowvale on the insert name of river, and Brickyard Station. Worldbeat is smaller than Medicop's, handles more upscale contracts, supposedly has a bigger espionage arm. Though, if that's what people want, they just talk to an account rep at the Central Intelligence Corporation. And then there's the enforcers. But they cost a lot and don't take well to supervision. It is rumored that, under their uniforms, they wear T-shirts bearing the unofficial enforcer coat of arms. A fist holding a nightstick emblazoned with the words, "Sue me." So YT is coasting down a gradual slope toward the heavy iron gate of White Columns, waiting for it to roll aside, waiting, waiting, but the gate does not seem to be opening. No laser pulse has shot out of the guard shack to find out who YT is. The system has been overridden. If YT was a stupid ped, she would go up to the Medicop and ask him why. The Medicop would say, "The security of the city-state," and nothing more. These burbclaves, these city-states, so small, so insecure that just about everything, like not mowing your lawn or playing your stereo too loud, becomes a national security issue. No way to skate around the fence. White Columns has 8-foot iron robo-rot all the way around. She rolls up to the gate, grabs the bars, rattles it, but it's too big and solid to rattle. Medicops aren't allowed to lean against their unit, makes them look lazy and weak. They can almost lean, look like they're leaning. They can even brandish a big leaning against the car too, like this particular individual, but they can't lean. Besides, with the complete glinting majesty of their personal portable equipment suite, hanging on their personal modular equipment harness, they would scratch the finish of the unit. "Jack this barrier to commerce, man. I got deliveries to make," YT announces to the Medicop. A wet, smacking burst, not loud enough to be an explosion, sounds from the back of the mobile unit. It is the soft thump of a thick wrestler's loogie being propelled through a rolled-up tongue. It is the distant, muffled splurt of a baby having a big one. YT's hand, still gripping the bars of the gate, stings for a moment, then feels cold and hot at the same time. She can barely move it. She smells vinyl. The Medicop's partner climbs out of the back seat of the mobile unit. The window of the back door is open, but everything on the mobile unit is so black and shiny, you can't tell that until the door moves. Both Medicops, under their glossy black helmets and night vision goggles, are grinning. The one getting out of the mobile unit is carrying a short-range chemical restraint projector, a loogie gun. Their little plan has worked. YT didn't think to aim her night visions into the back seat to check for a goo-firing sniper. The loogie, when expanded into the air like this, is about the size of a football. Miles and miles of eensy but strong fibers like spaghetti. The sauce in the spaghetti is sticky, goopy stuff that stays fluid for an instant when the loogie gun is fired, then sets quickly. Medicops have to tote this kind of gear because when each franchulate is so small, you can't be chasing people around. The perp, almost always an innocent thrasher, is always a 3-second skateboard ride away from asylum in the neighboring franchulate. Also, the incredible bulk of the personal modular equipment harness, the chandelier gear, and all that is clipped onto it slows them down so bad that whenever they try to run, people just start laughing at them. So instead of losing some pounds, they just clip more stuff onto their harnesses, like the loogie gun. The snotty, fibrous drop of stuff has wrapped all the way around her hand and forearm and lashed them onto the bar of the gate. Excess goo has sagged and run down the bar a short ways, but is setting now, turning into rubber. A few loose strands have also whipped forward and gained footholds on her shoulder, chest, and lower face. She backs away, and the adhesive separates from the fibers, stretching out into long, infinitely thin strands, like hot mozzarella. These set instantly, become solid, and then break, curling away like smoke. It is not quite so gratendous, now that the loogie is off her face, but her hand is still perfectly immobilized. You are hereby warned that any movement on your part not explicitly endorsed by verbal authorization on my part may pose a direct physical risk to you, as well as consequential psychological and possibly, depending on your personal belief system, spiritual risks ensuing from your personal reaction to said physical risk. Any movement on your part constitutes an implicit and irrevocable acceptance of such risk, the first medicop says. There's a little speaker on his belt, simultaneously translating all of this into Spanish and Japanese.
Or as we used to say, the other medicop says, freeze, sucker!
The untranslatable word resonates from the little speaker, pronounced esucker and saka, respectively. We are authorized deputies of Medicops Unlimited. Under Section 24.5.2 of the White Columns Code, we are authorized to carry out the actions of a police force on this territory. Such as hassling innocent thrashers, YT says. The Medicop turns off the translator. By speaking English, you implicitly and irrevocably agree for all our future conversation to take place in the English language, he says. You can't even res with YT says, YT says. You have been identified as an investigatory focus of a registered criminal event that is alleged to have taken place on another territory, namely, the Mews at Windsor Heights.
That's another country, man. This is White Columns.
Under provisions of the Mews at Windsor Heights Code, we are authorized to enforce law, national security concerns, and societal harmony on said territory also. A treaty between the Mews at Windsor Heights and White Columns authorizes us to place you in temporary custody until your status as an investigatory focus has been resolved.
Your ass is busted, the second medicop says.
As your demeanor has been non-aggressive, and you carry no visible weapons, we are not authorized to employ heroic measures to ensure your cooperation, the first medicop says.
You stay cool and we'll stay cool, the second medicop says.
However, we are equipped with devices included but not limited to projectile weapons, which, if used, may pose an extreme and immediate threat to your health and well-being.
Make one funny move and we'll blow your head off, the second medicop says.
Just unglom my fucking hand, YT says. She has heard all this a million times before. White Columns, like most burbclaves, has no jail, no police station. So unsightly. Property values. Think of the liability exposure. Medicops is a franchise just down the road that serves as headquarters. As for a jail, some place to habeas the occasional stray corpus. Any half-decent franchise strip has one. They are cruising in the mobile unit. YT's hands are cuffed together in front of her. One hand is still half-encased in rubbery goo, smelling so intensely of vinyl fumes that both medicops have rolled down their windows. 6 feet of loose fibers trail into her lap, across the floor of the unit, out the door, and drag on the pavement. The medicops are taking it easy, cruising down the middle lane, not above issuing a speeding ticket here and there, as long as they're in their jurisdiction. Motorists around them drive slowly and sanely, appalled by the thought of having to pull over and listen to half an hour of disclaimers, advisements, and tangled justifications from the likes of these. The occasional Cosa Nostra delivery boy whips past them in the left lane, orange lights aflame, and they pretend not to notice.
"What's it gonna be, the Hoosgow or the Clink?" the first medicop says.
From the way he is talking, he must be talking to the other medicop. "The Hoosgow, please," YT says.
"The Clink,"
the other medicop says, turning around, sneering at her through the anti-ballistic glass, wallowing in power. The whole interior of the car lights up as they drive past a buy-and-fly. Loiter in the parking lot of a buy-and-fly, and you'd get a suntan. Then world-beat security would come and arrest you. All that security-inducing light makes the Visa and MasterCard stickers in the driver's side window glow for a moment.
YT is card-carrying, YT says. "What does it cost to get off?"
"How come you keep calling yourself Whitey?"
the second medicop says. Like many people of color, he has misconstrued her name.
"Not Whitey, YT," the first medicop says.
"That's what YT is called," YT says.
"That's what I said," the second medicop says. "Whitey, YT," the first one says, accenting the T so brutally that he throws a glittering burst of saliva against the windshield. "Let me guess. Yolanda Truman? No. Yvonne Thomas? No. What's it stand for?"
"Nothing."
"Actually, it stands for yours truly, but if they can't figure that out, fuck 'em."
"You can't afford it," the first medicop says. "You're going up against TMAWH here."
"I don't have to officially get off. I could just escape."
"This is a class unit. We don't support escapes," the first medicop says.
"Tell you what,"
the second one says.
"You pay us $1 trillion, and we'll take you to a Hoosgow. Then you can bargain with them."
"Half a trillion," YT says.
$750 billion,
the medicop says.
"Final. Shit, you're wearing cuffs. You can't be bargaining with us."
YT unzips a pocket in the thigh of her coverall, pulls out the card with her clean hand, runs it through a slot on the back of the front seat, puts it back in her pocket. The Hoosgow looks like a nice new one. YT has seen hotels that were worse places to sleep. Its logo sign, a saguaro cactus with a black cowboy hat resting on top of it at a jaunty angle, is brand new and clean.
"The Hoosgow, premium incarceration and restraint services. We welcome busloads."
There are a couple of other medicop cars in the lot, and an enforcer paddy bus parked across the back, taking up 10 consecutive spaces. This draws much attention from the medicops. The enforcers are to the medicops what the Delta Force is to the Peace Corps.
"One to check in," says the second medicop.
They are standing in the reception area. The walls are lined with illuminated signs, each one bearing the image of some Old West desperado. Annie Oakley stares down blankly at YT, providing a role model. The check-in counter is faux rustic. The employees all wear cowboy hats and five-pointed stars with their names embossed on them. In back is a door made of hokey old-fashioned iron bars. Once you got through there, it would look like an operating room. A whole line of little cells, curvy and white like prefab shower stalls. In fact, they double as shower stalls. You bathe in the middle of the room. Bright lights that turn themselves off at 11 o'clock. Coin-operated TV. Private phone line. YT can hardly wait. The cowboy behind the desk aims a scanner at YT, zaps her barcode. Hundreds of pages about YT's personal life zoom up on a graphic screen.
"Huh," he says, "female."
The two medicops look at each other like, what a genius. This guy could never be a medicop.
"Sorry, boys, we're full up. No space for females tonight."
"Oh, come on.
See that bus in back? There was a riot at Snooze and Cruise.
Some Narcolumbians were selling a bad batch of vertigo. Place went nuts. Enforcer sent in a half a dozen squads, brought in about 30. So we're full up. Try the clink down the street.
YT does not like the looks of this. They put her back in the car, turn on the noise cancellation in the back seat so she can't hear anything except squirts and gurgles coming from her own empty tummy, and the glistening crackle whenever she moves her glommed-up hand. She was really looking forward to a hoosegow meal. Campfire chili or bandit burgers. In the front seat, the two medicops are talking to each other. They pull out into traffic. Up in front of them is a square illuminated logo. A giant universal product code in black on white with buy and fly underneath it. Stuck onto the same signpost, beneath the buy and fly sign, is a smaller one. A narrow strip in generic lettering. The clink. They are taking her to the clink. The bastards. She pounds on the glass with cuffed together hands, leaving sticky handprints. Let these bastards try to wash the stuff off. They turn around and look right through her, the guilty scum, like they heard something but they can't imagine what. They enter the buy and fly's nimbus of radioactive blue security light. Second medicop goes in, talks to the guy behind the counter. There's a fat white boy purchasing a Monster Trucks magazine, wearing a new South Africa baseball cap with a Confederate flag, and overhearing them, he peers out the window, wanting to lay his eyes on a real perp. A second man comes out from back, same ethnicity as the guy behind the counter. Another dark man with burning eyes and a bony neck. This one is carrying a three-ring binder with the Buy and Fly logo. To find the manager of a franchise, don't strain to read his title off the name tag. Just look for the one with the binder. The manager talks to the medicop, nods his head, pulls a keychain out of a drawer. Second medicop comes out, saunters to the car, suddenly whips open the back door.
"Shut up," he says, "or next time I fire the loogie gun into your mouth."
"Good thing you like the clink," YT says, "'cause that is where you will be tomorrow night, loogie man."
"Is that right?"
"Yeah, for credit card fraud."
"Me cop, you thrasher. How you gonna make a case at Judge Bob's judicial system?"
"I work for Radic KS. We protect our own."
"Not tonight, you don't. Tonight you took a pizza from the scene of a car wreck. Left the scene of an accident. Radic KS tell you to deliver that pizza."
YT does not return fire. The medicop is right. Radic KS did not tell her to deliver that pizza. She was doing it on a whim.
"So Radic KS ain't gonna help you. So shut up."
He jerks her arm and the rest of her follows. The three-ringer gives her a quick look, just long enough to make sure she is really a person, not a sack of flour or an engine block or a tree stump. He leads them around to the fetid rump of the buy and fly, dark realm of wretched refuse and teeming dumpsters. He unlocks the back door, a boring steel number with jimmy marks around the edges like steel-clawed beasts have been trying to get in. YT is taken downstairs into the basement. First medicop follows, carrying her plank, banging it heedlessly against doorways and stained polycarbonate bottle racks.
"Better take her uniform. All that gear," the second medicop suggests, not unlewdly.
The manager looks at YT, trying not to let his gaze travel sinfully up and down her body. For thousands of years, his people have survived on alertness, waiting for Mongols to come galloping over the horizon, waiting for repeat offenders to swing sawed-off shotguns across their checkout counters. His alertness right now is palpable and painful. He's like a goblet of hot nitroglycerin. The added question of sexual misconduct makes it even worse. To him, it's no joke. YT shrugs, trying to think of something unnerving and wacky. At this point, she's supposed to squeal and shrink, wriggle and whine, swoon and beg. They are threatening to take her clothes. How awful. But she does not get upset, because she knows that they are expecting her to. A courier has to establish space on the pavement. Predictable law-abiding behavior lulls drivers. They mentally assign you to a little box in the lane, assume you will stay there, can't handle it when you leave that little box. YT is not fond of boxes, YT establishes her space on the pavement by zagging mightily from lane to lane, establishing a precedent of scary randomness, keeps people on their toes, makes them react to her, instead of the other way around. Now these men are trying to put her in a box, make her follow rules. She unzips her coverall all the way down below her navel. Underneath is naught but billowing pale flesh. The medicops raise their eyebrows. The manager jumps back, raises both hands up to form a visual shield, protecting himself from the damaging input.
No, no, no,
he says. YT shrugs, zips herself back up. She's not afraid. She's wearing a dentata. The manager handcuffs her to a cold water pipe. Second Medicop removes his newer, more cybernetic brand of handcuffs, snaps them back onto his harness. First Medicop leans her plank against the wall, just out of her reach. Manager kicks a rusty coffee can across the floor, caroming it expertly off her skin so she can go to the bathroom. Where are you from? YT asks.
Tajikistan, he says.
Tajik, she should have known.
Well, shit-can soccer must be your national pastime.
The manager doesn't get it. The medicops emit rote, shallow laughter. Papers are signed. Everyone else goes upstairs. On his way out the door, the manager turns off the lights. In Tajikistan, electricity is quite the big deal. YT is in the clink.
Amala quinza pantam cal nunca
Seven. The black sun is as big as a couple of football fields laid side by side. The decor consists of black square tabletops hovering in the air. It would be pointless to draw in legs. Evenly spaced across the floor in a grid, like pixels. The only exception is in the middle, where the bar's four quadrants come together, 4 = 2². This part is occupied by a circular bar 16 meters across. Everything is matte black, which makes it a lot easier for the computer system to draw things in on top of it. No worries about filling in a complicated background. And that way, all attention can be focused on the avatars, which is the way people like it. It doesn't pay to have a nice avatar on the street, where it's so crowded and all the avatars merge and flow into one another. But the Black Sun is a much classier piece of software. In the Black Sun, avatars are not allowed to collide. Only so many people can be here at once, and they can't walk through each other. Everything is solid and opaque and realistic, and the clientele has a lot more class. No talking penises in here. The avatars look like real people. For the most part, so do the demons. Demon is an old piece of jargon from the Unix operating system, where it referred to a piece of low-level utility software, a fundamental part of the operating system. In the Black Sun, a demon is like an avatar, but it does not represent a human being. It's a robot that lives in the metaverse. A piece of software, a kind of spirit that inhabits the machine, usually with some particular role to carry out. The Black Sun has a number of demons that serve imaginary drinks to the patrons and run little errands for people. It even has bouncer demons that get rid of undesirables, grab their avatars and throw them out the door, applying certain basic principles of avatar physics. David has even enhanced the physics of the Black Sun to make it a little cartoonish so that particularly obnoxious people can be hit over the head with giant mallets or crushed under plummeting safes before they are ejected. This happens to people who are being disruptive, to anyone who is pestering or taping a celebrity, and to anyone who seems contagious. That is, if your personal computer is infected with viruses and attempts to spread them via the Black Sun, you had better keep one eye on the ceiling. Hero mumbles the word, Big Board. This is the name of a piece of software he wrote, a powerful tool for a CIC stringer. It digs into the Black Sun's operating system, rifles it for information, and then throws up a flat square map in front of his face, giving him a quick overview of who's here and whom they're talking to. It's all unauthorized data that Hero is not supposed to have. But Hero is not some bimbo actor coming here to network. He is a hacker. If he wants some information, he steals it right out of the guts of the system Gossip Ex Machina. Big Board shows him that David is ensconced in his usual place, a table in the Hacker Quadrant near the bar. The Movie Star Quadrant has the usual scattering of sovereigns and wannabes. The Rockstar Quadrant is very busy tonight. Hiro can see that a Nipponese rap star named Sushi K has stopped in for a visit. And there are a lot of record industry types hanging around in the Nipponese Quadrant, which looks like the other quadrants except that it's quieter, the tables are closer to the floor, and it's full of bowing and fluttering geisha demons. Many of these people probably belong to Sushi K's retinue of managers, flacks, and lawyers. Hiro cuts across the Hacker Quadrant, headed for David's table. He recognizes many of the people in here, but as usual, he's surprised and disturbed by the number he doesn't recognize. All those sharp, perceptive 21-year-old faces. Software development, like professional sports, has a way of making 30-year-old men feel decrepit. Looking up the aisle toward David's table, he sees David talking to a black-and-white person. Despite her lack of color and shitty resolution, Hiro recognizes her by the way she folds her arms when she's talking, the way she tosses her hair when she's listening to David. Hiro's avatar stops moving and stares at her, adopting just the same facial expression with which he used to stare at this woman years ago. In reality, he reaches out with one hand, picks up his beer, takes a pull on the bottle, and lets it roll around in his mouth, a bundle of waves clashing inside a small space. Her name is Juanita Marquez. Hiro has known her ever since they were freshmen together at Berkeley, and they were in the same lab section in a freshman physics class. The first time he saw her, he formed an impression that did not change for many years. She was a dour, bookish, geeky type, who dressed like she was interviewing for a job as an accountant at a funeral parlor. At the same time, she had a flamethrower tongue that she would turn on people at the oddest times, usually in some grandiose, earth-scorching retaliation for a slight or breach of etiquette that none of the other freshmen had even perceived. It wasn't until a number of years later, when they both wound up working at Black Sun Systems, Inc., that he put the other half of the equation together. At the time, both of them were working on avatars. He was working on bodies, she was working on faces. She was the face department, because nobody thought that faces were all that important. They were just flesh-toned busts on top of the avatars. She was just in the process of proving them all desperately wrong. But at this phase, the all-male society of bitheads that made up the power structure of Black Sun Systems said that the face problem was trivial and superficial. It was, of course, nothing more than sexism, the especially virulent type espoused by male techies who sincerely believe that they're too smart to be sexists. That first impression back at the age of 17 was nothing more than that. The gut reaction of a post-adolescent army brat who had been on his own for about 3 weeks. His mind was good, but he only understood one or two things in the whole world. Samurai movies and the Macintosh. And he understood them far, far too well. It was a worldview with no room for someone like Juanita. There's a certain kind of small town that grows like a boil on the ass of every army base in the world. In a long series of such places, Hiro protagonist was speed-raised like a mutant hothouse orchid, flourishing under the glow of 1,000 buy-and-fly security spotlights. Hiro's father had joined the army in 1944 at the age of 16, and spent a year in the Pacific, most of it as a prisoner of war. Hiro was born when his father was in his late middle age. By that time, Dad could long since have quit and taken his pension, but he wouldn't have known what to do with himself outside of the service, and so he stayed in until they finally kicked him out in the late 80s. By the time Hiro made it out to Berkeley, he had lived in Wrightstown, New Jersey, Tacoma, Washington, Fayetteville, North Carolina, Hinesville, Georgia, Killeen, Texas, Grafenwöhr, Germany, Seoul, Korea, Ogden, Kansas, and Watertown, New York. All of these places were basically the same, with the same franchise ghettos, the same strip joints, and even the same people. He kept running into school chums he'd known years before, other army brats who happened to wind up at the same base at the same time. Their skins were different colors, but they all belonged to the same ethnic group. military. Black kids didn't talk like black kids. Asian kids didn't bust their asses to excel in school. White kids, by and large, didn't have any problem getting along with the black and Asian kids. And girls knew their place. They all had the same moms, with the same generous buttocks and stretchy slacks, and the same frosted and curling ironed hairdos, and they were all basically sweet and endearing and conforming, and if they happened to be smart, they went out of their way to hide it. So the first time Hiro saw Juanita, or any other girl like her, his perspectives were bent all out of shape. She had long, glossy black hair that had never been subjected to any chemical process other than regular shampooing. She didn't wear blue stuff on her eyelids. Her clothing was dark, tailored, restrained. And she didn't take shit from anyone, not even her professors, which seemed shrewish and threatening to him at the time. When he saw her again after an absence of several years, a period spent mostly in Japan, working among real grown-ups from a higher social class than he was used to, people of substance who wore real clothes and did real things with their lives, he was startled to realize that Juanita was an elegant, stylish knockout. He thought at first that she had undergone some kind of radical changes since their first year in college. But then he went back to visit his father in one of those army towns and ran into the high school prom queen. She had grown up shockingly fast into an overweight dame with loud hair and loud clothes who speed-read the tabloids at the checkout line in the commissary because she didn't have the spare money to buy them, who popped her gum and had two kids that she didn't have the energy or the foresight to discipline. Seeing this woman at the commissary, he finally went through a belated, dim-witted epiphany. Not a brilliant light shining down from heaven, more like the brown glimmer of a half-dead flashlight from the top of a stepladder. Juanita hadn't really changed much at all since those days, just grown into herself. It was he who had changed. Radically. He came into her office once, strictly on a business matter. Until this point, they had seen each other around the office a lot, but acted like they had never met before. But when he came into her office that day, she told him to close the door behind him, and she blacked out the screen on her computer and started twiddling a pencil between her hands and eyed him like a plate of day-old sushi. Behind her on the wall was an amateurish painting of an old lady, set in an ornate antique frame. It was the only decoration in Juanita's office. All the other hackers had color photographs of the space shuttle lifting off or posters of the Starship Enterprise. "It's my late grandmother, may God have mercy on her soul," she said, watching him look at the painting. "My role model."
Why, was she a programmer?
She just looked at him over the rotating pencil like, how slow can a mammal be and still have respiratory functions? But instead of lowering the boom on him, she just gave a simple answer. "No." Then she gave a more complicated answer. "When I was 15 years old, I missed a period. My boyfriend and I were using a diaphragm, but I knew it was fallible. I was good at math. I had the failure rate memorized, burnt into my subconscious. Or maybe it was my conscious. I can never keep them straight. Anyway, I was terrified. Our family dog started treating me differently. Supposedly, they can smell a pregnant woman. Or a pregnant bitch, for that matter." By this point, Hiro's face was frozen in a wary, astonished position that Juanita later made extensive use of in her work. Because as she was talking to him, she was watching his face, analyzing the way the little muscles in his forehead pulled his brows up and made his eyes change shape. "My mother was clueless. My boyfriend was worse than clueless. In fact, I ditched him on the spot because it made me realize what an alien the guy was, like many members of your species." By this, she was referring to males. "Anyway, my grandmother came to visit," she continued, glancing back over her shoulder at the painting. "I avoided her until we all sat down for dinner, and then she figured out the whole situation in maybe 10 minutes, just by watching my face across the dinner table. I didn't say more than 10 words. Pass the tortillas. I don't know how my face conveyed that information, or what kind of internal wiring in my grandmother's mind enabled her to accomplish this incredible feat, to condense fact from the vapor of nuance." Condense fact from the vapor of nuance. Hiro has never forgotten the sound of her speaking those words, the feeling that came over him as he realized for the first time how smart Juanita was. She continued, "I didn't even really appreciate all of this until about 10 years later as a grad student, trying to build a user interface that would convey a lot of data very quickly for one of these baby killer grants." This was her term for anything related to the Defense Department. "I was coming up with all kinds of elaborate technical fixes, like trying to implant electrodes directly into the brain. Then I remembered my grandmother and realized, my God, the human mind can absorb and process an incredible amount of information if it comes in the right format, the right interface, if you put the right face on it. Want some coffee?" Then he had an alarming thought. What had he been like back in college? How much of an asshole had he been? Had he left Juanita with a bad impression? Another young man would have worried about it in silence, but Hiro has never been restrained by thinking about things too hard, and so he asked her out for dinner and, after having a couple of drinks, she drank club sodas, just popped the question. "Do you think I'm an asshole?" She laughed. He smiled, believing that he had come up with a good, endearing, flirtatious bit of patter. He did not realize until a couple of years later that this question was, in effect, the cornerstone of their relationship. Did Juanita think that Hiro was an asshole? He always had some reason to think that the answer was yes, but 9 times out of 10 she insisted the answer was no. It made for some great arguments and some great sex, some dramatic fallings out and some passionate reconciliations, but in the end, the wildness was just too much for them. They were exhausted by work, and they backed away from each other. He was emotionally worn out from wondering what she really thought of him, and confused by the fact that he cared so deeply about her opinion. And she, maybe, was beginning to think that if Hiro was so convinced in his own mind that he was unworthy of her, maybe he knew something she didn't. Hiro would have chalked it all up to class differences, except that her parents lived in a house in Mexicali with a dirt floor, and his father made more money than many college professors. But the class idea still held sway in mind, because class is more than income. It has to do with knowing where you stand in a web of social relationships. Juanita and her folks knew where they stood with a certitude that bordered on dementia. Hiro never knew. His father was a sergeant major. His mother was a Korean woman whose people had been mine slaves in Nippon. And Hiro didn't know whether he was black or Asian or just plain army, whether he was rich or poor, educated or ignorant, talented or lucky. He didn't even have a part of the country to call home until he moved to California, which is about as specific as saying that you live in the Northern Hemisphere. In the end, it was probably his general disorientation that did them in. After the breakup, Hiro went out with a long succession of essentially bimbos who, unlike Juanita, were impressed that he worked for a high-tech Silicon Valley firm. More recently, he has had to go searching for women who are even easier to impress. Juanita went celibate for a while and then started going out with David and eventually got married to him. David had no doubts whatsoever about his standing in the world. His folks were Russian Jews from Brooklyn and had lived in the same brownstone for 70 years after coming from a village in Latvia, where they had lived for 500 years. With the Torah on his lap, he could trace his bloodlines all the way back to Adam and Eve. He was an only child who had always been first in his class in everything, and when he got his master's in computer science from Stanford, he went out and started his own company with about as much fuss as Hiro's dad used to exhibit in renting out a new P.O. box when they moved. Then he got rich, and now he runs the Black Sun. David has always been certain of everything, even when he's totally wrong, which is why Hiro quit his job at Black Sun Systems, despite the promise of future riches, and why Juanita divorced David 2 years after she married him. Hiro did not attend Juanita and David's wedding. He was languishing in jail, into which he had been thrown a few hours before the rehearsal. He had been found in Golden Gate Park, lovesick, wearing nothing but a thong, taking long pulls from a jumbo bottle of Courvoisier, and practicing kendo attacks with a genuine samurai sword, floating across the grass on powerfully muscled thighs to slice other picnickers' frisbees and baseballs in twain. Catching a long fly ball with the edge of your blade, neatly having it like a grapefruit, is not an insignificant feat. The only drawback is that the owners of the baseball may misinterpret your intentions and summon the police. He got out of it by paying for all the baseballs and frisbees. But since that episode, he has never even bothered to ask Juanita whether or not she thinks he's an asshole. Even Hiro knows the answer now. Since then, they've gone very different ways. In the early years of the Black Sun Project, the only way the hackers ever got paid was by issuing stock to themselves. Hiro tended to sell his off almost as quickly as he got it. Juanita didn't. Now she's rich, and he isn't. It would be easy to say that Hiro is a stupid investor and Juanita a smart one, but the facts are a little more complicated than that. Juanita put her eggs in one basket, keeping all her money in Black Sun stock. As it turns out, she made a lot of money that way, but she could have gone broke, too. And Hiro didn't have a lot of choice in some ways. When his father got sick, the Army and the VA took care of most of his medical bills, but they ran into a lot of expenses anyway. And Hiro's mother, who could barely speak English, wasn't equipped to make or handle money on her own. When Hiro's father died, he cashed in all of his Black Sun stock to put Mom in a nice community in Korea. She loves it there, goes golfing every day. He could have kept his money in the Black Sun and made $10 million about a year later when it went public, but his mother would have been a street person. So when his mother visits him in the metaverse, looking tan and happy in her golfing duds, Hiro views that as his personal fortune. It won't pay the rent, but that's okay. When you live in a shithole, there's always the metaverse. And in the metaverse, Hiro protagonist is a warrior prince. Eight. His tongue is stinging. He realizes that, back in reality, he has forgotten to swallow his beer. It's ironic that Juanita has come into this place in a low-tech black-and-white avatar. She was the one who figured out a way to make Avatar show something close to real emotion. That is a fact Hiro has never forgotten, because she did most of her work when they were together. And whenever an Avatar looks surprised or angry or passionate in the metaverse, he sees an echo of himself or Juanita. The Adam and Eve of the metaverse makes it hard to forget. Shortly after Juanita and David got divorced, the Black Sun really took off. And once they got done counting their money, marketing the spin-offs, soaking up the adulation of others in the hacker community, they all came to the realization that what made this place a success was not the collision avoidance algorithms or the bouncer demons or any of that other stuff. It was Juanita's faces. Just ask the businessmen in the Nipponese Quadrant. They come here to talk turkey with suits from around the world, and they consider it just as good as a face-to-face. They more or less ignore what is being said. A lot gets lost in translation, after all. They pay attention to the facial expressions and body language of the people they are talking to. And that's how they know what's going on inside a person's head. By condensing fact from the vapor of nuance. Juanita refused to analyze this process, insisted that it was something ineffable, something you couldn't explain with words. A radical rosary-toting Catholic, she has no problem with that kind of thing. But the bitheads didn't like it, said it was irrational mysticism. So she quit and took a job with some Nipponese company. They don't have any problem with irrational mysticism, as long as it makes money. But Juanita never comes to the Black Sun anymore. Partly she's pissed at David and the other hackers who never appreciated her work, but she has also decided that the whole thing is bogus. That no matter how good it is, the metaverse is distorting the way people talk to each other, and she wants no such distortion in her relationships. David notices Hiro, indicates with a flick of his eyes that this is not a good time. Normally such subtle gestures are lost in the system's noise, but David has a very good personal computer, and Juanita helped design his avatar, so the message comes through like a shot fired into the ceiling. Hiro turns away, saunters around the big circular bar in a slow orbit. Most of the 64 bar stools are filled with lower-level industry people, getting together in twos and threes, doing what they do best, gossip and intrigue.
So I get together with the director for a story conference. He's got this beach house.
Incredible?
Don't get me started.
I heard Debbie was there for a party when Frank and Mitzi owned it.
Anyway, there's this scene, early, where the main character wakes up in a dumpster. The idea is to show how, you know, despondent he is.
That crazy energy.
Exactly.
Fabulous.
I like it. Well, he wants to replace it with a scene where the guy is out in the desert with a bazooka, blowing up old cars in an abandoned junkyard.
You're kidding.
So we're sitting there on his fucking patio over the beach, and he's going like, woom, woom, imitating this goddamn bazooka. He's thrilled by the idea. I mean, this is a man who wants to put a bazooka in a movie. So I think I talked him out of it.
Nice scene, but you're right. A bazooka doesn't do the same thing as a dumpster.
Hero pauses long enough to get this down, then keeps walking. He mumbles big board again, recalls the magic map, pinpoints his own location, and then reads off the name of this nearby screenwriter. Later on, he can do a search of industry publications to find out what script this guy is working on, hence the name of this mystery director with a fetish for bazookas. Since this whole conversation has come to him via his computer, he's just taken an audio tape of the whole thing. Later, he can process it to disguise the voices, then upload it to the library, cross-referenced under the director's name. 100 struggling screenwriters will call this conversation up, listen to it over and over until they got it memorized, paying Hero for the privilege, and within a few weeks, bazooka scripts will flood the director's office. Whoom! The Rockstar Quadrant is almost too bright to look at. Rockstar avatars have the hairdos that rockstars can only wear in their dreams. Hero scans it briefly to see if any of his friends are in there, but it's mostly parasites and has-beens. Most of the people Hero knows are will-bees or wannabes. The movie star quadrant is easier to look at. Actors love to come here because in the black sun, they always look as good as they do in the movies. And unlike a bar or club in reality, they can get into this place without physically having to leave their mansion, hotel suite, ski lodge, private airline cabin, or whatever. They can strut their stuff and visit with their friends without any exposure to kidnappers, paparazzi, script flingers, assassins, ex-spouses, autograph brokers, process servers, psycho fans, marriage proposals, or gossip columnists. He gets up off the bar stool and resumes his slow orbit, scanning the Nipponese quadrant. It's a lot of guys in suits, as usual. Some of them are talking to gringos from the industry. And a large part of the quadrant, in the back corner, has been screened off by a temporary partition. Big board again. Hero figures out which tables are behind the partition, starts reading off the names. The only one he recognizes immediately is an American. L. Bob Reif, the cable television monopolist. A very big name to the industry, though he's rarely seen. He seems to be meeting with a whole raft of big Nipponese honchos. Hero has his computer memorize their names so that later he can check them against the CIC database and find out who they are. It has the look of a big and important meeting.